Think about a master illusionist, right? Performing on stage. Like a magician waves a brightly colored, glittering silk scarf in his right hand. You stare at the colors, you watch the flutter, completely hypnotized by the spectacle of it all.
Right, you're entirely focused on the shiny object.
Exactly. Your brain is so overwhelmed by the sheer entertainment value that you don't even notice his left hand quietly slipping your watch right off your wrist. It's the ultimate misdirection. The bright colors occupy your conscious mind while the real action entirely bypasses all your defenses.
That is a phenomenal way to look at it, because you dazzle an audience with a catchy melody or a beautiful set piece, and their cognitive biases just kind of power down. They don't even realize their fundamental worldview is being challenged until the idea has already taken root in their minds.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, you and I are going to explore a piece of art that pulled off one of the greatest acts of cultural misdirection in American history. And we're talking about the 1949 Broadway musical South Pacific.
Yeah, it's a massive topic.
It really is. We are pulling from a comprehensive, incredibly detailed source article today that covers the show's creation, its plot, and its really massive cultural impact. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore exactly how this insanely popular mid-century piece of entertainment functioned as that magician's scarf, basically smuggling deeply controversial discussions about race and prejudice right into the heart of mainstream American culture.
And the source material we're looking at today is incredibly compelling for that exact reason. It bridges this immense gap between the gritty, muddy, bloody reality of the Pacific Theater in World War II and the, highly polished, glamorous world of Broadway. And by bridging that gap, it didn't just entertain people, it fundamentally changed how Americans consumed both music and ideology.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to really understand the impact, you have to understand the sheer scale of this show's success. Like it didn't just do well, it was a juggernaut.
No, totally unprecedented.
Right. It won 10 Tony Awards. 10. It is still the only show in history to win all four acting categories. It won a Pulitzer Prize. But if you just look at the glossy posters today, you might think it's just this fluffy escapist island romance. But it wasn't born in a comfortable New York office at all. It was actually born out of real near-death experiences.
Yeah, to understand how it became such a cultural force, we really have to start with the raw material, because the story originates with James Michener. And at the time, Michener was a birthright Quaker.
Wait, let me stop you there for a second, because the term birthright Quaker might not mean much to everyone listening today. That has huge implications for the military, doesn't it?
Huge implications. So Quakers are a religious group with a very long foundational history of pacifism. Being a birthright Quaker meant he was actually born into the faith, which gave him a highly respected, legally protected status as a conscientious objector.
Wow. So he didn't have to fight at all.
Exactly. He could have completely avoided military service during World War II without any pushback. He had a permanent, basically a get out of the draft free card, but he chose to waive that protection.
Really?
Yeah, he enlisted in the Navy anyway. Which, I mean, that tells you something about the profound personal compulsion he felt toward this conflict.
Yeah.
So he was sent to the South Pacific Theater to write a history of the Navy, which allowed him to travel widely.
And while he's traveling, he experiences this inciting incident that shifts his entire trajectory because he survives a horrific plane crash in New Caledonia, a literal near-death experience.
Right, and trauma like that completely changes a person.
It does. Our sources show it motivated him to start writing fiction. He wanted to document the real, raw, completely unfiltered stories of the soldiers and the locals he was meeting because he suddenly realized just how fleeting life actually was.
So he's sitting there on this battered typewriter in the middle of a war zone,
Right.
typing out what would eventually become his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Tales of the South Pacific, and he's capturing real people.
Yeah, and I absolutely love this specific detail from the source because he captured a character named Bloody Mary.
Oh, she's such a fascinating figure.
Right. She was based on a real Tonkinese woman he met. She was small, her face was literally stained red from chewing betel nut, and she swore constantly using this incredibly vulgar GI slang she'd picked up from the soldiers. Plus, she relentlessly complained about French colonialism, like she had actual concrete plans to oppose colonial rule in Indochina.
Which is an incredibly dense, politically charged reality to capture.
Exactly. Now, as a reader, that is fascinating. But as a theater producer, how do you look at a swearing anti-colonial betel nut chewer and think, yes, let's put her on a Broadway stage?
But that's what makes the next step of the journey so wild.
Right. It's like a wartime correspondent accidentally inventing modern pop culture. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II, the legendary Broadway duo, they buy the rights to Meisner's stories for a mere 1% of the gross.
Which, just as a side note, eventually made Meisner incredibly wealthy.
Oh, I'm sure. But Rodgers and Hammerstein were coming off a massive disappointment with a highly experimental show called Allegro, and they desperately wanted a guaranteed smash hit. So my question is, why on earth did they think these gritty, tragic war stories, where characters actually die in battle, would be a guaranteed hit? I mean, why not just write another happy musical?
What's fascinating here is that they didn't try to sanitize the grit to make it a hit. They actually leaned into it because they deeply understood the psychology of the post-war American public.
How do you mean?
Well, millions of soldiers had just come home completely changed by the horrors of war. The country had, in many ways, lost its innocence. Rodgers and Hammerstein realized that mere escapist fluff just wouldn't resonate the same way it used to. The audience was hungry for authenticity.
They wanted something that actually meant something.
Precisely. They recognized that the authenticity of Meisner's wartime setting was its greatest strength. For instance, in their previous massive hits, like Oklahoma and Carousel, they relied heavily on a dream ballet to convey emotion and story. It was a staple of the era.
Right, all the big shows had one.
Yeah, but for South Pacific, they completely scrapped the ballet. They felt the harsh realism of a muddy military base simply wouldn't support men leaping around in tights. They prioritized the authenticity of the war over the established, comfortable traditions of Broadway.
Okay, they commit to the realism. I respect that. But once they make that choice, the grittiness of the source material starts dictating some highly unconventional casting choices. And the way they built this show around two highly unusual lead actors completely shaped the unique DNA of the musical.
Unconventional is almost an understatement here. First, you have Ezio Pinza. He was cast as the male lead, Emile Debec, the middle-aged French plantation owner. Pinza was not a Broadway guy. He was a 58-year-old former Metropolitan Opera star.
Wow, 58.
Yeah, he was bored with the opera and looking for new worlds to conquer. But he had a very specific ironclad limitation in his contract. He was strictly limited to singing just 15 minutes per performance to protect his voice.
Wait, let me get this straight. You have a nearly 60-year-old opera singer starring in a Broadway musical, but he's only allowed to sing for 15 minutes.
That's right.
And opposite him, they cast the bubbly young American sweetheart Mary Martin as the naive nurse Nellie Forbush. That is quite an age gap and a massive stylistic gap. But our sources note Martin was completely intimidated by Pinza's massive, booming operatic voice. She actually only agreed to take the role after Richard Rodgers explicitly promised her that she and Pinza would never have to sing at the same time.
Yeah, he had to keep them vocally separated to protect her from being overpowered on stage.
Wait, I really have to push back on this. The biggest romantic musical of the era was purposely engineered to prevent the two romantic leads from actually singing together. How do you sell an epic, sweeping romance to an audience when the lovers can't even share a single duet? That sounds like a recipe for a massive theatrical flop.
It sounds like it, sure. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is a perfect example of how strict constraints often drive the greatest creative innovations. Because Rodgers couldn't rely on the crutch of a traditional duet, he had to invent a subconscious way to unite them. He created a specific four-note musical motif, a tetrachord, specifically C, B, A, G.
Okay. Can we get an ELI-5 on what a tetrachord actually is?
Of course. It's literally just a four-note scale played in sequence.
Yeah.
But think of it like a musical watermark or a psychological trigger. Have you ever noticed how the theme to the movie Jaws is basically just two notes, but the second you hear them, it immediately makes you think of the shark, even if the shark isn't on screen?
Aye, absolutely. The tension builds instantly.
Right. Rodgers did the exact same thing, but for romance. You hear the subtle four-note motif played in the orchestra before we even see either lead character. And then, that exact motif is woven repeatedly throughout Nellie's solo music and the background music when they share a scene, and even heavily in Emile's big solo, Some Enchanted Evening. It unites them psychologically and musically in the audience's mind. Their voices never intertwine, but their musical DNA is locked together.
That is brilliant. It's like musical invisible ink tying them together. The audience feels the romance without really knowing why. And speaking of creative solutions forced by the material, we have to talk about their director, Joshua Logan.
He was absolutely crucial to this.
Yeah, because Hammerstein really struggled with writing the military dialogue because, unlike Michener, Hammerstein hadn't served. But Logan was a veteran. He brought all that crucial military knowledge, the slang, the pacing, the cynical attitudes of soldiers waiting for battle. He actually ended up fighting for co-writing credit on the script, which he eventually got, though Rogers and Hammerstein made sure he didn't get any author's royalties for it.
Logan was fiery and demanding, but he fostered an environment of absolute realism. And Mary Martin fed off that. It was actually her brilliant idea while she was taking a shower during rehearsals to literally shampoo her hair live on stage.
Yes. The iconic song, "I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair." They didn't just mime it. They built a primitive military-style shower right there on the stage.
It was revolutionary for Broadway.
It wasn't just a prop. It was a real visceral action that grounded the musical in the daily, unglamorous reality of these soldiers and nurses. But all of this, the realistic sets, the clever musical motifs, the charming older Frenchman and the bubbly young nurse, it was all just the colorful silk scarf waving in the air. The trap was set. Now it was time for the misdirection to pay off.
Because underneath all those catchy tunes and the romance, South Pacific was engineered as a direct, unflinching confrontation with American racism.
The plot revolves around two serious romances. You have Nellie and Emile, and you have a young Marine lieutenant, Joe Cable and Liat, the young Tonkinese daughter of Bloody Mary. And both of these romances hit a brick wall for the exact same reason. The deep-seated racial prejudices of the Americans. Nellie, the sweet, relatable girl from Arkansas, finds out Emile has mixed-race Polynesian children from his late wife, and she is utterly repulsed. She rejects him entirely. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Cable is deeply in love with Liat, but he refuses to marry her because he knows his wealthy, high-society Philadelphia family would never accept an Asian woman.
And this all culminates in the most controversial moment of the show, Lieutenant Cable's song, "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught." It is a devastatingly blunt song. It drops all the metaphors completely. It explicitly states that racism is not something you are born with. It is a learned behavior. It has to be drummed into you by your family, your society, your upbringing.
Which was huge.
To put that message on a mainstream Broadway stage in 1949 was explosive.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And before we go further, you really have to imagine you were sitting in a theater in 1949. Looking at the sources provided for this deep dive, we have to pause here and be incredibly clear with you. Our source material brings up very charged political viewpoints from the 40s and 50s. We are impartially reporting the historical facts from our source, both the progressive anti-racist intentions of the writers and the fierce right-wing anti-communist backlash from the politicians of that era. We aren't taking any sides or endorsing either of these historical political viewpoints. We are just showing you the historical reality contained in the text.
And that neutral framing? That historical context is vital here, because the backlash they faced wasn't just a few bad reviews in a paper. It was immense and highly politicized. During the tryout performances, a prominent Boston critic strongly urged Rogers and Hammerstein to completely remove the song, citing the racial bigotry in the city. They warned that audiences simply wouldn't tolerate it, and it escalated significantly from there.
It really did. In 1953, while the show was touring in Atlanta, two Georgia state legislators, Senator Shepard and Representative Jones, actually tried to outlaw the show.
Outlaw it entirely?
Yeah. They publicly objected to the song, claiming it contained a philosophy inspired by Moscow. And to understand why they said that, you have to realize that in the segregated Jim Crow South, any push for racial integration was frequently branded as Marxist agitation meant to destabilize the social order. They explicitly argued that in the South they had, quote, pure bloodlines and intended to keep it that way, threatening legislation against what they called communist-inspired works.
And what's truly remarkable is Rogers and Hammerstein's total refusal to back down from that. When Michener told Hammerstein that people wanted the song cut to save the show, Hammerstein just laughed and said, "That's what the show's about." They didn't view the song as a tangential political statement. It was the entire thesis of the musical for them.
They held their ground.
They did. They even threatened to completely cancel a performance in Wilmington, Delaware, unless the theater integrated its racially segregated seating. And it worked. The theater caved. They integrated.
They wielded their massive economic power to force social change. I love that detail.
And this raises a crucial point about the sheer risk they were taking. South Pacific is the only major American musical set in World War II. But instead of taking the easy route, you know, just purely villainizing the Japanese or the Axis powers and giving the American audience a simple patriotic victory lap, they chose to turn the mirror entirely on the American audience. The primary villain in the narrative isn't the enemy army. It's the fatal flaw of American prejudice.
That is such a profound shift in perspective. But despite, or maybe honestly because of this massive controversy, the show didn't fail, it exploded. And the cultural shockwaves went way beyond the theater, completely altering everyday American consumer habits in ways you really wouldn't expect.
The commercial impact was unprecedented. Let's just look at the original cast album. Think about how people listened to music in 1949. You had these heavy, brittle, 78 RPM discs made of shellac. A Broadway cast album would literally be a bulky book with sleeves of heavy records, and you'd have to get up and flip to disc every 3 minutes.
Super inconvenient.
Exactly. But when Columbia Records released the South Pacific album, they released it on a brand new format. The LP, the 33 and a third RPM long playing record.
Which was a massive gamble. They were basically asking people to buy completely new hardware.
They were. But the album was such a gargantuan hit. It spent 69 weeks at number one and sold over 1 million copies. The desire to hear this specific music in high fidelity without constantly flipping discs was so strong that it's essentially trained the American public to adopt this new LP technology. People bought record players specifically for South Pacific.
Think about the last time you bought a completely new piece of tech just to consume one specific piece of media. This is like a hit Broadway show today, somehow forcing everyone to switch from Spotify to a totally new audio format overnight.
Right.
But it didn't just change the music industry. It simultaneously changed how American women styled their hair. Because we have to go back to Mary Martin's onstage shower.
The ripple effect of that one staging choice is fascinating.
Because Martin was actually washing her hair with soap on stage 8 times a week, she had to cut it incredibly short so it would dry quickly and look decent without constant professional styling. That onstage shower sparked a massive national fashion craze. Millions of American women suddenly wanted this short, manageable haircut. But the aha moment here is why they wanted it. It wasn't just about looking like Mary Martin. They started buying the consumer products needed to wash and style their hair daily at home, rather than going to a beauty salon once a week.
It was a huge shift.
It was a move toward independence. It literally changed the grooming habits of the nation.
And that ties beautifully into how the character of Nellie Forbush deeply resonated with the shifting gender roles of post-war America. Because during World War II, millions of women had entered the workforce. Think of Rosie the Riveter. They gained unprecedented independence and were earning their own money. Nellie represents that same wave of women serving as a Navy nurse overseas. But after the war ended, there was immense societal pressure on women to give up those jobs to returning men and go back to a quiet life of domesticity.
Right. And we see Nellie follow that exact culturally mandated trajectory. By the end of the show, she accepts her role as a mother to Emile's children. She transitions from an independent military nurse to a domestic caregiver.
Exactly. She conforms. And the creators were very deliberate about making her acceptable to that 1949 audience. In Meischner's original stories, Nellie's character was much more sexually liberated. She had a boyfriend back home and a physical liaison on the island. But Rodgers and Hammerstein completely sanitized her sexual past for this stage.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize they changed her that much.
Yeah, and this raises an important question about how change actually happens in society. They made Nellie an incredibly sweet, palatable, cockeyed optimist, precisely so the audience would fall in love with her. By carefully calibrating their radical messages about race within these comforting conventional wrappers, a charming romance, catchy tunes, traditional gender roles, they ensure the audience wouldn't reject the core lesson. Returning to your opening thought, light entertainment is often the most effective vehicle for shifting cultural norms because the audience's guard is down.
It's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. So what does this all mean? When we pull all these threads together, South Pacific wasn't just a collection of standard Broadway tunes. It was a daring translation of gritty, real-life war stories into a musical that forced Americans to sit in the dark and look closely at their own deep-seated prejudices. And it managed to do this while accidentally revolutionizing the recording industry with the LP record and changing the way American women styled their hair. It reminds you that the media you consume purely for fun or escapism often carries profound societal weight.
It absolutely does. And it leaves you with something important to mull over long after you finish listening today. Look around at the massive, record-breaking pop culture phenomenons of our current era. The billion-dollar blockbuster movies, the chart-topping albums that everyone is obsessing over. What hidden, radical societal shifts might they be smuggling into our living rooms right now, wrapped in catchy melodies and CGI explosions? What messages are we absorbing today that historians will only recognize as truly revolutionary a half century from now?
It really makes you wonder what's waiting inside the illusion once the cheering stops. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Catch you on the next one.